The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Instead of coming up with a list of things to begin, we think about the things we need to stop in 2023. Stop living by to-do lists. You know that feeling you get when you're being super productive, crushing items off your to-do list like a ninja of efficiency. Slash, 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 done, done, done. That feeling may be leading you off the path of happiness into an emotional no man's land. We think of productivity as getting things done as quickly as possible, but true productivity is making progress on the work that truly matters to us, and our to-do list can distract us from that, explains Cassie Holmes, PhD, author of Happier Hour, How to Beat Distraction, Expand Your Time, and Focus on What Matters Most. Holmes speaks from personal experience. She was walking her son to preschool, and he kept trying to point out things along the way, but Holmes was hurrying, thinking of the busy day ahead. Finally, a particularly emphatic, "Mom, look!" made her turn to find her son with his nose buried in a rose bush. When Holmes heard herself exclaim, "We don't have time to smell the roses," it was a wake-up call. How do you beat the productivity con? One way, Holmes suggests, is by elevating the routine to the ritual. Step 1. Begin with a mundane activity you enjoy. For Holmes, this is a weekly on-the-way-to-school coffee date with her daughter, which began as purely functional caffeine pit stop. Step 2. Estimate how many times you've done this activity. For Holmes, 400 coffee dates so far. Step 3. Estimate how many more times you're likely to do it. Accounting for the onset of adolescence, 230 coffee dates ahead. Step 4. Calculate the percentage you have left, 36% of coffee dates left. Recognizing that I only have 36% of my coffee dates with my daughter left makes me protect the time for this ordinary activity that has so much meaning for us, Holmes explains. And it helps me pay attention. My phone is away, I'm totally in the moment. Bottom line, the path to happiness involves a to-do list detox, plus sometimes math. Stop bedtime procrastination. If you're trying to exercise more, lose weight, start new habits, says Tara Doyle, MD, an integrative and functional medicine physician at Minnesota Personalized Medicine in Minneapolis, sleep is going to be an integral foundational building block for those things. As a perpetually sleep-deprived person, I didn't want to believe this, but a mammoth body of medical research makes clear it's irrefutable. Too little sleep has been consistently proved to increase appetite and food intake, according to a study published in Metabolism, and is associated with increased risk of hypertension, a leading cause of death, according to the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. When we sleep, our brain has the opportunity to take out the trash, explains Doyle. This leaves people able to perform at a higher level mentally, physically, and emotionally. The question of how to get 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night, the amount recommended by the National Sleep Foundation, is a thorny one, but for most people it involves ending revenge bedtime procrastination. You know what that is. You finally put the kids to bed or close your work laptop, and fighting off sleep, you binge Netflix or scroll through TikTok until you realize that you've killed your chances at a decent night's sleep. This is a habit you should kick this year, and as soon as I finish White Lotus, I'm kicking it with you. Stop punishing your body with exercise. Everyone everywhere knows that exercise is essential for health. My grandmother knows this. People who've lived in bunkers for several decades knows this. How essential? Well, regular exercise reduced causes of mortality by up to 30%, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's essential. Still, exercise, sigh, the sweating, the lungs burning, the stitch in the side. Maybe it's just the Catholic in me, but it feels like a penance. When I asked Rebecca Alexander, a psychotherapist in Manhattan and the author of Not Fade Away, what we should resolve to stop doing this year, her response is clear. People often exercise for punitive reasons, because of dissatisfaction with the way they look, or because they feel like they've eaten too much, she says. But you connect your mind with your body so much more when you see that taking care of your body is a major part of taking care of your mental health. Researchers are still trying to figure out the exact mechanism by which exercise improves mental health. Maybe it's the elevated endorphins, possibly it's something else. What they do know, through countless studies, is that it does help a lot. Regular exercise mitigates the effects of stress on the body, elevates mood, reduces anxiety, helps with depression, and even aids memory. Put that way, running on the treadmill seems like less a stint in a medieval penitentiary and more like a bubble bath. Stop panicking about the recession. If there's one thing I dread more than exercise, it's making a budget. Making a budget with a threat of a possible recession looming? Significantly more dread-inducing. So, I am exactly the kind of person that Andrea Warrick, budgeting expert in Bakersfield, California, is referring to when she says that the biggest mistake people make around budgeting is embracing a negative mindset. A budget allows you to enjoy the things you value, says Warrick, because it helps you avoid spending on unnecessary purchases or things that don't matter. One small way to save a lot of money is to curb impulse spending. The first step, Warrick says, is to figure out what's triggering the purchases. Maybe you hit buy when you're bored or sad, or maybe you're a sucker for a killer sale, or maybe you've got a social media-induced inferiority complex. Once you're aware of what's causing the impulse buys, set up some barriers for yourself. You can achieve this by deleting payment info and retail sites, says Warrick, and unsubscribing from retail newsletters and turning off sale notification in store apps. Having to enter all those credit card digits, plus the expiration date, plus the security code, will give you enough time to remember that you read an article just the other day that told you to cease and desist impulse buying. Stop rushing to respond. 90 seconds. That's how long it takes for the physiological response of an intense emotion to flood your body and then dissipate, according to Harvard-trained neuroscientist Jill Bolt-Taylor, Ph.D., interviewed in Psychology Today. This means that in a minute and a half, the flame of anger or embarrassment or disappointment will burn itself out, unless you ignite it all over again. This is the basis for the New Year's advice from Nick Tritton Jr., author of Stop Overthinking. Try to create separation from feeling an emotion to reacting upon it, he says. The longer the pause, the less powerful the impulse, and the more logic can kick in. Enter the 90-second rule. It's similar to the 5-second rule, except instead of helping you eat filthy floor donuts, it helps you not throw your phone out the window in a rage spiral. Rather than beating the clock, you want to write it out. For a minute and a half, focus on the seconds ticking by on a clock, or do deep breathing, or splash water on your face. Do anything but react to the trigger. When the 90 seconds are over, you'll have a much better shot at responding with intention rather than reacting in a way you'll later regret. Our next article by Barbara Kingsolver is titled, How the World Almost Shamed Me. When I was a girl growing up in Kentucky, I used to hear people tell West Virginia jokes. Then one summer, I made a friend from West Virginia, and of course she wasn't dumb. What's more, she'd heard them all too, but where she came from, they were told as Kentucky jokes. Or Tennessee jokes. Eventually, I went away to college and learned the joke was on all of us. Believe it or not, I was shocked to learn how direly the world looked down on us so-called hillbillies. This was not at Harvard or Yale, mind you. I hadn't learned yet that those elite places existed. It was central Indiana. Most of the students were from the North or Midwest, and oh, how they enjoyed looking down on me. One new friend gave me a Hoosier passport, offering Kentuckians limited rights to cross the Ohio River into Indiana. Naively, I signed up for the debate team, and for the few weeks I lasted, the coaches and judges couldn't hear my debate skills, if any, as they were fixated on all the words I said wrong. My fire was far. Pictures were pictures. The list grew long, and I gave up debate. But it didn't stop there. Strangers would quiz me in the dining hall to hear me say mayonnaise or syrup. I became a kind of mascot. It was not a position I enjoyed. It was unhelpful that the movie Deliverance had just been released, confirming the whole world's idea of us as backwoods degenerates. I hated that movie, but I've come to understand James Dickey didn't start this. Deliverance confirmed the stereotypes people already had and absolved them of guilt for their condescension. It was popular for the same reasons J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy was a runaway national success, even though it's despised by every Appalachian I know who has read it. The same cruel portrait of us persists to this day. Turn on the TV and you'll find it. If we show up at all, we're the ignorant bumpkins. And if you sat down with me now, you wouldn't hear me say fire and picture the way I used to, unless you're my neighbor, because I'm a code switcher, sliding between one dialect and another. When I'm far from home, the core of my accent evaporates along with my might coulds and fixing twos. But if the phone rings and it's family, it's, hi, what y'all doing? That's my first language, spoken only where I feel safe, with people who won't be judging my diction or fixing to throw me off the debate team. The back and forth is mostly unconscious. I never chose to hide my origins, but over several years, my vowels and syntax gradually conformed. You'll understand why if you've ever suffered ridicule for some external feature of yourself. It's natural to try to blend in so people might listen to what you're saying rather than getting stuck on your presentation. Code switching is common practice for those who speak languages other than standard English at home. Generations of these children have been wrongly diagnosed with speech impairment, but modern linguists are finally coming to respect Black English and other widespread dialects as fully coherent languages with their own complex rules. I hope someday the world will have the same regard for my native tongue rather than slapping a straw hat and a cruel joke on any man, woman, or child who says, I reckon. I know now my first language wasn't wrong. I can write and love characters who are full-on Appalachian in word and deed, but it took me a lot of years to find them. I surrendered my home identity in early adulthood when blending in seemed necessary to my success. If I wrote fiction or poetry, I thought it had to come from some sophisticated, culturally neutral place I was trying to invent. In other words, not Kentucky. But a culturally neutral place is actually no place at all, so I wrote a boatload of terrible short stories. Luckily, nobody read them. I was a biology major driven by practicality as one of the few lucky souls from my high school who got to go to college. Stories and poems were just my private way of processing my experience. After college, I traveled the world working at low-paying jobs, trying on worldly new identities, writing more exotic poems and short stories, and they were still 100% god-awful. Eventually, I landed in Arizona, where I acquired a decent low-paying job and friends and another new identity as a Tucsonan. I wrote about what I saw in my rundown neighborhood. Elderly people and families living on the threshold of poverty, immigrants who had fled terrible persecution. I listened to people's stories and invented my own that were, for the first time, maybe not completely terrible, but they still felt hollow. I lacked a voice. The book that changed my life was Shiloh and Other Stories by Bobby Ann Mason. I read it in one sitting, blown away by one simple fact. All the characters were Kentuckians. They went to church and worked at Kmart and canned green beans. I remember finishing the book and hugging it. Such was the revelation that rocked my world. A real writer could sound like me, the real me who had gone into hiding for so many years. I promptly burrowed into a rich vein of other Kentucky writers, from Wendell Berry all the way back to Harriet Arnau. Then I pulled out the short stories I'd been trying to write about people in a ramshackle Tucson neighborhood. I invented a new character from a little town in Kentucky who would tie them all into one story narrated in her own dialect. That's how I found my voice and how my first novel, The Bean Trees, came to be. As soon as I was able, I moved back to these mountains where I live in what we call a holler, in a farmhouse where I plan to stay the rest of my days. As a writer, my project is to represent Appalachia honestly, countering stereotypes with nuance, giving full account to our rich culture and the beauty of our place. This is not to deny our challenges. We have devastating unemployment, in some counties rising over 50%. We're plagued by underfunded schools, limited health care, and deaths of despair. We didn't ask for any of it. Blaming the victims, suggesting we're too lazy to want any better, is dead wrong. The driver of these problems is structural poverty. Outside financial interests spent centuries extracting our resources, deliberately keeping out other kinds of employment, undermining our culture of education. It goes back as far as the Whiskey Rebellion and extends most lately to Big Pharma targeting us as vulnerable, pumping in the oxy, leaving us with a generation of kids growing up without parents. These stories need to be told. I see that as my job. If I can tell you one thing about Appalachians, let it be this. We are people made of community. We grow up well aware and often reminded of how we're beholden to those around us. We don't just know our neighbors, we bring them dinner in times of sickness or grief. We take in family, and that word throws a wide net. We pitch in with farm labor or fundraisers or looking after the kids, or we accept these kinds of help when needs exceed capacity. We tend to be churchgoers, funeral goers, porch sitters, storytellers. When we sit down with a new acquaintance, we always start with the same question. Who are your people? Only after we've established how we're related, genetically or through some shared history, can we move on. Because it matters. We are all related through our shared experience. It's the root of our resilience. I love this about us and can hardly believe how much baby I once tried to throw out with the bathwater. I have compassion for that younger Barbara, though. Shame is a powerful force. Kids grow up faster and wiser now, using multiple media to watch the world in all its rowdy diversity, and that knowledge surely has value. But in some ways, the global village is no friend to us. It's only natural for anyone, when looking at cultural icons, to want to see some reflection of oneself. And that's too bad for Appalachians. I'm forever on the lookout for farmers or other rural people in film or TV or the news, and I don't mean comedies, but real stories of our concerns and the actual work of our days. Instead, I see a predictable caricature, the Beverly Hillbillies updated to a reality show wallowing in backwardness, or a poverty documentary. The problem with the global village is that it's tilted in favor of urban concerns and money and people who don't talk like us. The shameful hazing that fell on me when I left Kentucky for college is ever present now. For most kids, it starts earlier. It makes us mad, and that's dangerous. The great divides in our country will not be healed until everybody at the table feels valued. I'm drawn to the characters who don't feel they have a place at the table. They've heard too many conversations that begin, "You poor backward soul living in the middle of nowhere." Possibly even the reader is thinking those thoughts because my characters aren't perfect. They have a lot to learn. The heart of a novel is human transformation, but if I do my job right, outsiders will better understand us as peers in dignity and humanity. And I'm writing for Appalachians too, trying to nail down what's good about us. Our resourcefulness, our music and gardens and canned green beans. I know a book like that can change a person's life, because a book like that changed mine. I'm trying hard these days to keep a tighter hold on my native accent. It's risky. I still meet judgment and recoil from it, but a world that can shame our language from our tongues will leave us with no voice at all. It almost happened to me. I'm lucky beyond words that I found my way back home. Barbara Kingsolver is the author of the forthcoming Demon Copperhead, a contemporary retelling of David Copperfield set in Appalachia at the onset of the opioid epidemic. She is also the author of 10 best-selling works of fiction, including the novels Unsheltered, Flight Behavior, The Lacuna, The Poisonwood Bible, Animal Dreams, and The Bean Trees, as well as books of poetry, essays, and creative nonfiction. Her work of narrative nonfiction is the influential bestseller Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. Kingsolver's work has been translated into more than 20 languages and has earned literary awards and a devoted readership at home and abroad. She was awarded the National Humanities Medal, our country's highest honor for service through the arts, as well as the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for the body of her work. She lives with her family on a farm in southern Appalachia. Our next article by Deanna Rayborn is titled Fabulous Things About Being Over 50. The fact that I wrote a book, Killers of a Certain Age, about female assassins doesn't raise too many eyebrows. It is the fact that these killers are 60 that has gotten people talking. 60 conjures images of the Golden Girls in elastic waist pants with a side order of crocheted doilies. Four postmenopausal women wearing bootcut jeans and talking frankly about their active sex lives and hot yoga practices has taken a lot of folks by surprise. Even readers who are morally opposed to these characters murdering for a living often find themselves making allowances on the grounds that it is just so unexpected to see women of a certain age kicking ass. My killers might be popping hormone replacements and worried about their next bone density scan, but they can still plan and execute a mission like a bunch of 20-year-olds, even if they need ibuprofen and ice packs afterwards. Naturally, this has led to a lot of interviewers inquiring about my own experience with aging. At 54, I've been through the menopause tunnel and come out the other side, and I can tell you it is as demanding and unpredictable as any Indiana Jones adventure. I've navigated the rapids of night sweats, ridden out mood swings, and roamed the barren desert that is hot flashes. It is messy and unlovely and deeply demoralizing at times. Meeting yourself in a mirror in your 50s is like encountering a stranger you once knew but can barely remember. Something about her is vaguely familiar, but when did she get so old? This person who feels 16 inside and can remember all the moves she used when dancing on a tabletop to take on me in 1985 has somehow become the grown-up in the room. She has a mortgage and a son-in-law and remembers to vote in midterm elections. She also finds that first thing in the morning, her joints sound like Rice Krispies, and she can no longer remember the planets in order. It would help if they'd make up their minds about Pluto already. But it's not all stiffening joints and slowing memories, I promise you. We might mourn the loss of perky boobs and smooth skin and the ability to get up off the couch without making the kinds of creaking noises you'd usually find in a haunted house, but there are compensations in abundance, silver linings that aren't hard to find once you make up your mind to look. A tremendous gift is the fact that other people demand so much less of you in some areas as you get older. Pop culture, technology, current events. Nobody expects me to be completely conversant with any of it, so they are pleasantly surprised if I am. I don't have to know my Baby Yoda memes or all the lyrics to WAP, but if I do, I get nothing but praise because no one anticipates it. Those lowered expectations also mean that nobody looks to me to be the best-dressed, most fashion-forward person in the room. As long as I don't show up in a unicorn onesie, I'm passably fine, and I could probably get away with even that if I really wanted to. I choose boots instead of heels, have thrown out every bra with underwire, and God help us all if my jeans don't come with a little four-way stretch in them. I can throw on a biker jacket with a tulle skirt, and the vibe is cool grandma wannabe instead of escaped circus performer. The counterpart to other people's more modest expectations is that I now have higher ones for myself. This stage in my life is a good spot to stop and look around, evaluating where I am and who I am. I can make peace with the things I'll never do and set priorities for what I can. I might never be an Olympic figure skater, but I can still take classes on anti-racism and work on being a better ancestor. I'll never surf or master calculus or piano, but I can clearly see the wall my own forefathers and mothers built and even pull out a few bricks because I understand now that building it might not have been my doing, but it was done by people who look like me, and it's going to take people who look like me to help pull it down. I have a better grasp of my own place in society and my responsibility to use my privileges for good where I can. I can speak with authority and be heard because I've got a voice and I'm not afraid to raise it. Underpinning all of those advantages is the biggest of them all, my confidence. The French, of course it was the French, coined the delectable phrase, bien dans sa peau, to be good in one's skin. It means, among other things, accepting the visible signs of aging as badges of honor, regarding crow's feet and belly rolls and sun-splash freckles as the marks of a well-lived life. The laugh lines I have are from purely enjoying myself. The extra weight comes courtesy of delicious cheeses and bottles of wine shared with my husband, and those spots were earned on beaches, soaking in the sunshine and doing nothing more demanding than listening to the roll of the waves. Would I be healthier if I'd been more abstemious? Probably. But would I be happier? Definitely not. The companionship and pleasure in making these memories probably did as much for my mental health as the extra butter did for clogging my arteries. Of course, those charcuterie boards and beach vacations came from knowing myself and figuring out that sushi and scuba diving are not for me. There's so much pressure not just to do things, but to make them into Instagrammable moments, starring in mid-topics with a new installment dropping every day. We watch other people's glamorous reels while our own mortality clocks are tick-tocking down the minutes, every clip hammering home the fact that we'll never have pantries that tidy, cocktails that inventive, dance moves that slick. And that's truly and perfectly fine. I'm never going to be the person who enjoys baby showers, contemporary jazz, or Pilates. My spices will never be alphabetized, and I will never use a 17-step skincare regimen. For people who like those things, they're wonderful. I am just not that woman, and that knowledge is freeing. There is nothing as liberating as authenticity, because pretending to like things takes so much effort. As my friend Holly says, the older you get, the more of a relationship you develop with yourself instead of just other people, and that relationship breeds confidence. I have the confidence now to just give things a go when I'm interested. I seize opportunities that excite me, even if I don't know whether I'll succeed. And that isn't because I'm confident in my abilities as much as I am in my resilience. Even if I fail, I'll get up because I've done it before and recovery is a muscle memory. If I'd had this confidence at 20, I'd be buying Twitter. I know my limitations, and they're growing each year, but I also know what I do well, and I'm getting better at it every day. Deanna Rayborn is the New York Times bestselling author of Killers of a Certain Age. She is also the author of the Edgar Award-nominated Veronica Speedwell Mysteries, with the 8th book in the series, A Sinister Revenge, publishing in March 2023, as well as the Lady Julia Gray series and several standalone works. Our next article by Lee Newman is titled, Five New Book Clubs You've Never Ever Heard Of. You may have countless films, TV shows, and podcasts available to stream at the click of a button, but there's nothing like a classic book club meeting. And there's a type of book club that suits just about everyone. Read on for more. Number one, the club that shares the same DNA. Over the winter holidays, during summer break at the beach house, or any other time when your extended family gets together, try presenting each member with the same book. As Grandma, Aunt Jane, Mom, and Uncle Frank's new shy girlfriend hang by the fire at night or linger around the coffee pot in the morning, they'll read, as opposed to lecturing on their particular politics or hinting as to who should mop the kitchen floor. At night, over dinner, the group will also have something relatively safe and engaging to discuss, as opposed to talking about exactly how dry the turkey is or why Aunt Jane decided to join a coven. What works? Rotating who chooses the book so everyone gets a chance. Also, keeping the book a secret until everybody arrives. This is not one of those things you want your older brother or grumpy Uncle Boris to weigh in on ahead of time. What doesn't work? Forgetting to put each person's name in big blocky letters on the title page, leading to books getting confused, places being lost, and irritation setting in. Number two, the under 1 hour of reading club. We all love our book clubs, but there comes a time when even the most ideal group, think stimulating novels, insightful members, priceless wines, organic caviar, a live harpist in the corner who strums ethereal notes after every comment, gets a little stale or intimidating to outsiders. Take Joanna Goddard. She always wanted to join one, but she knew she was a slow reader and that she'd never finish a 300-page novel or memoir, unlike the rest of us who always finish. Her idea? Start a club based on something that takes only 45 minutes to read, the old-fashioned in-depth article. Articles are so digestible, she says, and they're real life, which makes them easier to relate to. Another bonus is that the ideas discussed in those pieces tend to be controversial, which leads to lots of fun, even heated debate. Goddard picks her articles from publications like the New York Times, The New Yorker, and Harper's Magazine about topics that range from education to divorce. What works? Articles about dating, marriage, siblings, family conflicts, anything that lets members weave in personal context to the factual content. One big winner in Goddard's group was the New York Times Modern Love column about a husband who announced to his wife, "I don't love you anymore." What doesn't work? Articles that have only one argument, such as too much alcohol is bad for you. Everybody agrees it's true, and then the discussion pretty much dies. Number three, the Choose Your Own Novel Club with a side of pizza. If you're the kind of person who buys armloads of juicy new novels, then rushes home only to shove them on a shelf where they sit there and sit there and sit there, either because you're too busy buying more books or you're still trying to finish that fat, magnificent paperback edition of Middlesex you started in 2004, this club is for you. Tiffany's son, formerly of Oprah.com, was drowning in books but just couldn't find the time, energy, or willpower to read them. She and a close friend decided to approach reading like dieting, where you have a buddy who keeps you on track with your eating plan because she's doing it too, son says. In their club, each member reads the book she already owns. When finished with the book, she enters the title, rating, her name, and any comments she wants to make about it into a Google spreadsheet that's shared with everyone. Here comes the part that's not, in any way, shape, or form, like dieting. Once everyone has finished three books, all of each person's choosing, the group goes out for pizza to talk about their choices and experiences, as well as to celebrate with a sausage pie. That reward hovering in the distance is a real motivator, Sun says. I'm not going to lie to you. Without the pizza, I don't think any of us would make it all the way to the end month after month. What works? The Google spreadsheet keeps members connected as they read separately and gives them a feeling of accomplishment. Sun's group also inserts a colored bar that marks the end of every reading session and lists the name of the pizza place they visited. They check out a different restaurant each time. What doesn't work? Members who read at different speeds. One of our friends was able to read three books a month while the rest of us were struggling to finish even one book in the same amount of time, Sun says. That got discouraging pretty quickly. Number four, the club with a never-ending supply of books. This option is so obvious, you just might overlook it. Many bookstores organize their own book clubs. Now that everything everywhere happens over the internet all the time, says Zach Zook, a former coordinator for the small indie shop Book Court in Brooklyn, we're seeing a real desire from customers for face-to-face interactions. Sure, they come for the joy of talking about the tiger's wife with strangers, who in most cases have read the book. They're not coming for the old friends and intricate hot appetizers. But they also like the honest reactions. Nobody has to be very, very careful how she talks about, say, the lead character who cheats on her husband. Another perk? The flexibility. You can come once, then not come again for 4 months, says Ann Corey Watson, the former coordinator of Book Court's club. Not to mention, we're completely inclusive. Anybody can come. You don't have to be insanely smart or well-read. We'll take anybody, and we have the room for them. What works? Buying your book for the following meeting as soon as the current one ends, eliminating the errand of obtaining the next title, and being relaxed about summer when the group shrivels. They come back in the fall, Corey Watson says. Promise. What doesn't work? Because of the luscious selection of new releases piled on nearby tables and shelves, you'll be tempted to buy only recently published titles. But Corey Watson's group found that many of the new books just weren't strong enough to generate discussion. They also read a mixture of recent and time-tested titles. Number five, the Singles Club. No, we don't mean a pickup book club, though asking out the guy who can recite the last page of Eat, Pray, Love is never a bad idea. We're talking about one of the most fascinating ways to read, Kindle Singles, published only for e-readers. Officially, Amazon defines these timely pieces as anything that falls into a vast spectrum of reporting, essays, memoirs, narratives, and short stories presented to educate, entertain, excite, and inform. Unofficially, we understand them as novellas, short story collections, such as Jodi Picoult's Leaving Home, which is three brief pieces of fiction, and longer nonfiction works that are too short to be books. Think Christina Nering's riveting Journey to End of Light about her Down syndrome baby diagnosed with leukemia. The bonus, each one is less than the price of a magazine. What works? E-readers help discussion by letting members search by word or phrase, ending the whole frustrating, I know I remember the passage. It was about a rose and dog, like at the end or like at the beginning. You can also highlight key passages and use Twitter, Facebook, Meetup, Squidoo, Library Thing, and other social platforms to discuss books between meetings. What doesn't work? Expecting everyone to have the same e-reader. You can still buy a Kindle single no matter what device. It will work just fine. Our next article by Liesl Schillinger is titled 16 Delightful Sayings We Need to Bring Back. There's a world of linguistic options to share how we feel, but we often repeat the same common phrases. That stops here. Read on to learn how to express yourself a lot more colorfully in everyday conversation. In a faunch. Holly Golightly called it having the mean reds, but when you're furious, sulking, or bad-tempered, for a good reason or not, your ancient Midwestern relations are likely to observe that you were in a faunch. The expression is said teasingly and indulgently, and it's worth reviving because it recognizes that dark moods come to us all and often shouldn't be taken too seriously. If you have a best friend who occasionally blows up at you over small things, take it in stride and tell yourself she's in a faunch and know that it will pass. Sleep knits up the raveled sleeve of care. Lady Macbeth praised the healing properties of sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care. Picture a sweater with a frayed cuff and imagine that cuff re-knitting itself and becoming whole again. That's what happens to your psyche when you sleep. It restores itself. This bit of wisdom got a friendlier exponent in the form of Jeeves, P.G. Wodehouse's valet hero, who liked to quote it to his feckless young employer, Bertie Wooster, when he came home tired and fuddled from too much reveling at the Ritz. But even if your cares are heavier than Bertie's, rest will lighten them. The same fire that melts butter forges steel. These fierce words of encouragement acknowledge that it's tough to achieve your ambitions. Not everyone can take the heat, and doing so requires fortitude and resolve. To say that the same fire that melts butter forges steel is to exhort someone to take pride in the difficulty of overcoming obstacles. Taking on challenges is daunting, but the prospect of overcoming them can strengthen and inspire. Get back to my rat killing. An easygoing yet effective way to end a rambling phone conversation comes from a humorous phrase used in the last century by people who were not far removed from rural life and remembered the need to defend barns and silos from hungry, four-footed invaders. This is how my mild, blue-eyed Illinois grandmother, who grew up on a corn and soybean farm, signed off on phone calls. It just means I've got to get back to work. So the next time a friend texts you when you're in the middle of a project, you can reply once or twice, then text that you've got to get back to your rat killing. To fold yourself in four. Do you knock yourself out for people, take pains, go the extra mile? Dutiful French people do too, but when they go into contortions to please others, they call it folding yourself in four, se plier en quatre. This is a picturesque way to capture the effort of benevolent exertion and suggests a touch of remarkable perfectionism. Not just bending over backwards, but bending four times. Sacre bleu. Not my circus, not my monkeys. It's flattering to be valued and to have your input sought. But when your friends and colleagues try to rope you into projects that will overload your crazy schedule, try to resist the temptation to be indispensable. Tell yourself with relief, as they do in Warsaw, that it's their problem, not yours, and they could easily ask someone else or rely on themselves. Repeat after us, not my circus, not my monkeys. The original phrase is Niemoj cirk, Niemoj, but don't bother trying to say it in Polish. That's not your circus. It takes a very long time to become young. Picasso believed that truly original expression comes from seeing the world as a child does, with fresh eyes and without preconception. To achieve that level of creative freedom in his artwork took him decades. He had to let go of the formal rules of technique he had learned as he matured. When someone asked him why his paintings looked childlike, he took it as a compliment. "It takes a very long time to become young," he responded. This comment serves as a reminder that it takes conscious effort to hold on to the conviction and vision of your young, idealistic self. When the fox preaches, look to your geese. Not everyone who has advice to give means well by it. Sometimes speakers' words serve themselves, not their audience. A cautionary German expression shows the risk of self-interested counsel. When the fox preaches, look to your geese. If you've ever worked in an office where the management talked about cost-cutting measures, you understand the implications. It's also a useful thought to hold in any election season. What looks like love is always love. Men and women tiptoe around this four-letter word, fearing to be the first to say it, fearing it will not be reciprocated if declared, fearing the word's weight might sink their relationship, and acting as if heartbreak could be avoided by keeping it out of the conversation. The playwright Tristan Bernard denounced this semantic caution. He wrote, "What looks like love is always love. Your heart knows what your lips don't say," he implied. In other words, love will make itself felt no matter what you call it. Have your head in the handlebars. If you've ever watched the Tour de France, you've seen cyclists speeding along the route, pedaling like mad, hunched over their handlebars. They certainly are not taking time to appreciate the scenery. All they're thinking of is the finish line. A person who is so focused on her work and her end goals that she pays too little attention to every other aspect of her life is said by the French to have her head in the handlebars. Sick as a parrot. If you're feeling poorly, borrow a page from the avian kingdom and say you're sick as a parrot. Why a parrot? Remarkably, this curious comparison predates the Monty Python dead parrot sketch. Several lively theories, none of them provable, explain its origin. One is that parrot smugglers from South America used to sedate birds to sneak them quietly across the border to U.S. buyers. When the birds awoke from their drugged sleep, groggy and stumbling, their new owners thought they looked hungover and coined the whimsical comparison. Another theory suggests that parrot is a corruption of the French word pirate, i.e. a pasty-faced clown. Still others point to pisticosis, a contagious bird flu, or credit a mention in a 17th century play by Aphra Behn. In any case, if you are unsteady on your pins, have a flutter with this metaphor and take two aspirin. The eggs are teaching the hen. Sometimes children say or do things that show them to be wiser than their elders. Russian parents have a grudging way of describing this phenomenon, the eggs shouldn't teach the hen. But Tolstoy, more generous-mindedly, flipped the phrase in War and Peace. When young Natasha Rostov told her flurried parents they ought to make room in their wagons for wounded soldiers as the family fled Moscow, her father was moved by her noble impulse and said humbly, "The eggs are teaching the hen." Tolstoy knew that insight is not necessarily tied to age. Watch your six. Military pilots must be sharp-eyed, scouting out dangers ahead of them and on all sides. They use the hands of a clock to indicate from which direction trouble is coming. But there remains one spot that is the most vulnerable of all. 6 o'clock, the position directly behind them. So whether in the air or the sea or on the ground, when one soldier tells another, "I've got your six," it means I'm looking out for you. When you're feeling vulnerable, remember that problems often come from where you least expect them, and a friend may be your best defense. Enough to make a cat laugh. Cats have no trouble making humans laugh. By now, Tom and Jerry, LOLcats.com, and the most extreme sourpuss of them all, Grumpy Cat, have made that abundantly clear. But how often do humans return the favor? Rarely, judging from an expression from the American South, enough to make a cat laugh. It's not known what it was that provoked such whiskered mirth, but it must have been hilarious indeed. All behind like a cow's tail. If you ever feel overwhelmed because you can't possibly get all the things done that you have to, then you're a lot like Mrs. Bridges, the cook in Upstairs Downstairs, who wailed that she was all behind like a cow's tail when she was running late in her dinner preparations. The phrase was common at the turn of the last century, but the Roman writer Petronius actually minted the expression 2,000 years ago. And for the record, Mrs. Bridges did catch up in time. Don't borrow a jack. Have you ever gotten angry at somebody preemptively because you thought they might get angry at you? This perverse but all too human predicament is called borrowing a jack. The phrase comes from a Shaggy Dog story the comic actor Danny Thomas told on his TV show in the 1950s. A traveler had a flat tire while driving in the country and discovered he didn't have a jack. Spotting a farmhouse a mile off, he started walking toward it so he could borrow a jack and change his tire. But as he walked, he convinced himself that the farmer wouldn't trust him, would think he was a con man, and would refuse his request. By the time the traveler got to the house, he was so offended that when the farmer came to the door, he shouted at him, "You can keep your dang jack," and stomped off. The moral of this one is, have a little faith. Our next article by Elizabeth Gilbert is titled, Resilience is All About What You Choose to Focus On. Elizabeth Gilbert is the best-selling author of Eat, Pray, Love and City of Girls. This article first appeared as The View from Here in the June 2016 issue of O, the Oprah magazine. My beloved Grandma Nini died in 1984. A few months after her funeral, her three adult children, my aunt, my uncle, and my father, gathered in their childhood home to see their mother's belongings. It was a sad job and an important one, and they were all feeling especially tender-hearted and unguarded that weekend. At one point, they found themselves sitting around the old kitchen table, eating sandwiches and talking about the past. My uncle, the baby of the family, looked at the refrigerator and said, "I can still see Mom standing there pouring me a glass of milk. Do you remember that sweet thing she always used to do whenever she got us a glass of milk? Remember how she'd take a tiny sip first to make sure it wasn't spoiled? Always looking out for us." My father, the analytical engineer of the family, raised his eyebrows. "No," he said, "you are so wrong. Mom wasn't sipping our milk to test it for freshness. She was sipping our milk because she always overfilled the glass. She had no sense of spatial relations. It used to drive me crazy." My brilliantly sardonic aunt looked at her two brothers like they were the biggest idiots she'd ever seen. "You're both wrong," she said. "Mom was stealing our damn milk." So what have we learned about my grandmother from this story? Was she a devoted caregiver, an incompetent dunderhead, or someone who would steal the milk out of the mouths of her children? Or maybe just an exceptionally thirsty woman? The world will never know the truth. But does the truth really matter? I don't think so. The older I get, the less interested I am in investigating the truth about our lives, and the more interested I become in the way we see that truth. Because what seems to matter in the end is not so much what happens to us, but how we perceive what happens to us. That perception ultimately becomes the world that we will inhabit. This is not to say we shouldn't be honest. There are certainly instances in life when we must demand that painful truths be exposed and dealt with, and I'm definitely not making some Orwellian argument here, claiming that facts are not facts. Without a doubt, facts are facts. But facts can take us only so far. For instance, everyone in my family agrees that my grandmother always sipped the milk. That's a stone-cold fact. But what did her milk sipping mean? Ah, now we have entered into the realm of perspective, and now limitless interpretations are possible. This is why two people, or three in the case of my dad and his siblings, can experience the exact same circumstances in life and turn out completely different. A trauma that might make one person a monster can make another a hero. An incident that you might read as a gift, I might consider a curse. What I hear as a compliment, you might hear as an insult. Listen, we're not always in control of our fate, and that is a fact. You may be robbed, or you may be blessed, or some combination of the two, most likely, but that's not really the point. The point is, if you feel like you're constantly being robbed, then you live in a world that's all about constantly being robbed. And if you feel like you're constantly being blessed, then you live in a world that's all about constantly being blessed. What we usually see when we interpret our lives is nothing but ourselves. As the truth gets screened through a thousand-layer filter composed of all our weirdness and wonderfulness. If we try to see things with the most generous eyes, searching for the truth, yes, but then bestowing upon that truth the brightest and kindest interpretation, we can learn how to perceive a more beautiful world. Do that, and I promise you this, you will get to live in one. Our next article by Princess Gabara is titled, Do Ultimatums Really Work? A Relationship Expert Sounds Off. Put a Ring on It, an unscripted series on OWN, follows three longtime couples under the close guidance of master relationship coach Dr. Nicole LaBeach. During their weeks-long social experiment of dating other people, each couple's relationship is put to the test with the ultimate goal of determining if they're meant to be together or if it's time to part ways. Season 3 recently wrapped, but as fans wait to hear whether the show is returning for a fourth season, Dr. Nicole is lending her insight to a few relationship-specific questions from our Oprah Insiders. Check out Dr. Nicole's expert advice ahead. Question from Insider. I've been with my significant other for over 10 years, and he still hasn't put a ring on it, even though we have a family. He knows I want to get married, and he says I'm his everything, but he just doesn't propose. In my previous relationship, I basically gave an ultimatum, but I really do not want to do that again. Other than the fact that we are not married, everything else is great. He never married before, but shares children with other women. He had a previous relationship of over 10 years as well, and his ex left him for a similar reason. Am I overthinking this? His parents divorced when he was young, so do you think this may have influenced him? He says it will happen, but should I really expect it after 10 years? Dr. Nicole, you are not overthinking this. However, it's in the best interest of the relationship to engage a third party, e.g. relationship coach, therapist, marriage counselor, to help you manage moving forward. A trained third party will help you understand each other's past, present fears, and personal needs regarding marriage. Your partner's parents divorcing, his other 10-year relationship, and your present dynamic invite an opportunity for greater understanding. There's power in discovering what may be valued, fueling decisions unresolved and/or causing pain in this area. A professional can help you facilitate the process. Your "he says it will happen, but should I really expect it after 10 years" comment is insightful. In every relationship, there are spoken and unspoken agreements on proverbial terms and conditions. So what did you agree to regarding the topic of marriage? Did you put your needs regarding marriage and other things in the background? Is this a problem that has shown up in multiple relationships in your life? We teach others how to treat us, and advocating for ourselves is a muscle that requires continuous development. And lack of muscle mass is sure to lead to resentment, unhappiness, regret, anger, and a myriad of preventable stressors. Now the question is, are you ready to renegotiate the terms of your agreement, and is he willing to renegotiate? Authentically sharing your heart and seeking new terms that address your intimate needs will promote clarity and give you the best chance of walking together in agreement. Instead of an ultimatum, focus on negotiating equitable terms to build forward with a greater capacity for honesty, vulnerability, and healing any damaged emotions. Waiting or refusing to seek help will only promote more of the same, a diminishing of one or the other's needs, not having difficult conversations, and further weakening the relationship's viability over time. Together, a third party and renegotiated agreement will give you the opportunity to progress toward a plan and timeline for marriage. In the same vein, actions such as refusing to receive help or communicate on the issue and co-create a mutually beneficial future should be accepted as a declaration that marriage is not the true intention your partner seeks to manifest. Question from Insider. My husband and I have always done inner work separately through therapy that we then share with each other, and we use that information to support our process and growth. The most recent area we are working on individually is prioritizing oneself and our needs before those of others. Both of our trauma responses have been either taking care of others or acknowledging others' feelings before our own. As we enter this new stage of our individual personal growth, can you share some details about how to ensure we can each prioritize our needs without the other feeling as if they have not been acknowledged? Dr. Nicole. First, I celebrate the care you've both taken to understand your trauma responses and advocate for your personal and relational growth. It's powerful and insightful to understand your responses to trauma. Knowing how trauma has affected you offers a gateway to freedom and healing from it. Both promote greater health in romantic relationships. However, not knowing can make you blind to how it may be driving your decisions, needs, patterns, and attraction to further sources of pain and dysfunction. When you're unaware of unhealed or damaged emotions, it can affect your ability to take risks, trust, as well as be emotionally available and intimately connected while avoiding emotional harm to those you're in a relationship with. To further support your goals of prioritizing your needs and acknowledging each other, I recommend being more vulnerable and authentic in your communication as a couple. As a best practice, commit to check-ins that give you the opportunity to share your feelings, practice active listening, focus on hearing rather than responding, and confirm that the other person feels heard. At first, this may seem a little contrived, but you'll see the true value of each experience. In case you're thinking, what should we talk about, don't underestimate the art of the following. Number one, powerful questions to help you connect, e.g., how do you feel? Did that decision advocate for you? How can I support you? What hurts? Do you feel heard? Am I asking the right questions? Can you see the difference in your response and how you would have responded in the past? Were you being authentic? Were you afraid of anything? How did you show vulnerability? Number two, affirmations to show your partner you notice and appreciate their effort. E.g., I see you. You've truly grown. That was inspiring. That took a lot of courage. You did it. Thanks for advocating for yourself. You matter. Just because it wasn't pleasant doesn't mean it wasn't good. You're making a difference. I support your decision. Over time, you'll find check-ins will promote greater intimacy and ensure you don't lose touch. And as you advocate for being your most authentic self with your partner, one of the ways to self-check that you're remaining committed is to ensure your communication and actions are devoid of four things: the need to hide, defend, prove, or protect. It will give you the needed permission to be fully you and connect at another level to stay true to yourself. Together, these shifts will support your being seen, heard, understood, and prioritized without promoting feelings of inadequacy, rejection, or isolation in your relationship. That you're remaining committed is to ensure your communication and actions are devoid of four things: the need to hide, defend, prove, or protect. It will give you the needed permission to be fully you and connect at another level to stay true to yourself. Together, these shifts will support your being seen, heard, understood, and prioritized without promoting feelings of inadequacy, rejection, or isolation in your relationship. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.